Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio's Off the Shelf for Saturday, the first Saturday in May of 2010. May the first Saturday and the first day in May. And I want to thank you for joining us here this morning. It is such a joy and a privilege to have you here with us. I am your host, Denise Turney, coming to you live, as always, from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. It is so sunny and gorgeous outside today. Thank you, Lord, for this beautiful day. And as always, I thank you for your support. I encourage you, don't let another day pass before you pick up a copy of Long Walk Up. Long Walk Up is a powerfully moving and inspirational book that you need to add to your book collection. You can pick up a copy of Long Walk Up today by visiting www.chistell.com. You can also pick up a copy of Long Walk Up at Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, Borders, Walmart, in any bookstore. If you don't see it on the shelf, just ask the clerk for it, and they can order you a copy because it's carried by the largest book distributors in the world. And now on this blessed day, we're waiting for him to join us. His name is Gummer Singdal Vidalt. Just to give you an introduction, as we wait for him to dial in, Gummer Singdal, he is a man who has worked and lived in the world of celebrity, particularly in the sports celebrity arena for several years, especially in boxing and with the Floyd Mayweather, Sugar Shane Mosley fight coming up in Vegas tonight. I want to ask him a few questions about that fight when he dials in. And Gummer Singdal, he's seen and experienced a lot of successes, and these people in the industry who have achieved a lot of great successes in sports and in other parts of the entertainment industry. He has also lived through some trying challenges, and very trying challenges, that he discusses in his book, You Only Live Twice, which I love the title of his book. As soon as he dials in, we're going to talk with him about his book and some of the things that he is doing to work with youth and to help youth to avoid some of the mistakes that he made in his life so they don't have to experience some of the pains that he experienced in his life. And until he joins, and I always say this on Off the Shelf, say a prayer that everything with Gummer Singdal is okay, because I'm not sure why he is, what the delay is for him joining is. But I just wanted to say, always be prepared, because you never know what is going to happen. So always be prepared, and if you have a confidence in yourself, you can easily just keep going along and have preparations, backup things that you're going to do. I actually didn't have anything prepared, but I do know to just keep moving. I wanted to share with the writers here who listen to Off the Shelf, since this is, you know, a literary show that we focus on writing, how to grow your writing career and how to market and promote your works. For the writers who are looking for paying writing jobs, I wanted to give you a little tip. If some of the sites that you can look into, they list regularly, generally every single day, you'll find some new writing jobs on these sites. And Gummer Singdal just joined. But I want to finish telling you, Media Bistro, and that's spelled the way it sounds, M-E-D-I-A, Bistro, B-I-S-T-R-O, is a site. And then also Journalism Jobs and Morning Coffee. Those are three good sites for the writers who are looking for paying writing jobs. And please let me know when you find Atlanta good writing spot. Don't stay encouraged. Don't be discouraged. And keep going after your dreams and what it is you truly want. And now we're going to connect to Gummer Singdal. Gummer Singdal?
Yes, can you hear me?
Hi. We actually have started the show. So glad to have you. I introduced you to our listeners here at Off the Shelf and told them about just a little intro to your book, You Only Live Twice, and about your experience dealing with people, you know, in the boxing arena and the world of sports. And with the May the 1st, just happened to schedule the interview on the same date as the Floyd Mayweather Shane
Mosley. Yeah, that's something. Yeah, that's an exciting day, exciting morning, exciting evening.
It just happened to land on that day, and I didn't even realize that till later in the week. I said, wow, it was just on a date of a boxing match, and I think in the same weight class that with the boxers that you knew competed in. And in your book, I wanted to just to let our listeners know that you get right to the chase. Talk about growing up on the streets of Spanish Harlem, and the mistakes and the close misses for our listeners. Gummer Sindal talks about in his book, You Only Live Twice, the mistakes and close misses he's had in his life, and he's very candid as he talks about these events, and You Only Live Twice, which is online at, and I encourage you to bookmark this URL. It's www.yoltbooks.com. Again, for our listeners here at Off the Shelf, you can get Gummer Sindal Vidal's book, You Only Live Twice, at www.yoltbooks.com. So so happy to have you here, Gummer Sindal. I'm just going to get right into the interview. I see on the website, again, and is the book available like at Barnes & Noble for our listeners?
It will be by the end of the month, yes.
Okay.
Barnes & Noble and Borders Books.
Okay. And they can go either online or offline and get it?
Well, right now it's online, and there's a couple websites that have it. I don't have a listing here right now, but like I said, by the end of May, I'll be available in Borders, Amazon, and Barnes & Noble.
Okay, Borders, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, those are the big booksellers, and Yote Books. I see it on the website at www.yoltbooks.com that you were in the Philadelphia, or do you live in Philadelphia? It was like you were doing an event on April the 17th, a book signing at the Philly Spy Shop. I wanted to ask you, how did the book signing go for You Only Live Twice there in Philadelphia?
That went well. That went very well. In fact, I saw some friends I haven't seen in about a good 10, 15 years, and that was exciting. And the former police commissioner, Sylvester Johnson, who's very, very involved in community, actually more involved in the community than some of the politicians are today, who are getting paid. And he showed up. He drove all the way from Delaware.
Oh, my goodness.
I wouldn't miss it for the world. And that was just a great, great surprise. And I loved it. Loved it. So him and I are going to be doing some things together.
That's
because,
good.
We have the same goals.
That's good. I want to, during the interview, just to let you know, talk about your true life book for our listeners. This is not a fictional book. This is a true life book based on his life experience that Gummer Sindal Vidal has written, You Only Live Twice. I want to talk about, during this interview, the writing process and marketing a little bit, just the format for Off the Shelf. But then I want to talk mainly about your book. And to begin, I want to ask you, how did you arrive at the title for your book? When I first saw it, I kind of took me back, and maybe that was the purpose for the title, because you always hear You Only Live Once. So
yeah,
your book
well,
is titled
title The title actually came probably after the book.
Okay.
I wasn't sure of a title. I really wasn't sure of a title, but as I was getting into the book and my thoughts were coming back of my childhood, and I looked at myself and I said, "Man, I was dead. I was pretty much dead. Spiritually, mentally, I mean, emotionally, I was out of it. And if it wasn't for my faith in God, and if it wasn't for my will." And all these people that had taught me things at children's villages, different places, that came back to me, I would have been dead. So I was given a second chance. So I lived twice, and I think we all do. I think we have an opportunity to live, make our mistakes, and live again, you know, and leave that past behind us, and just move on.
And
that's what I did, and that's what these kids do.
That's so important, what you said, to leave the past behind you, because a lot of times we drag it around with us over and over, and we just keep making the same mistakes over. So I'm so glad that you said that. For the off-the-shelf listeners, And as a sort of a prelude to my next question, just want to let you know we're a little bit about Spanish Harlem as I go in and ask Gumersino a few questions about his childhood and the book itself. But Spanish Harlem is located in East Harlem, and before the 1950s, it had a larger Italian population. And before that, it was a larger German immigrant population. Today, it has a predominantly, I would say, Hispanic population, although Italian families continue to live in the area. And it was during the 1960s and the 1970s that the East Harlem really toughened. Some of the organizations there for our listeners who might be from the city or live around New York, maybe in Jersey, the Mount Sinai Hospital, the Boys Choir of Harlem, the Church of the Living Hope, the East Harlem Cafe. They're just some of the few businesses and organizations in the area. And like any place on earth, you don't care what you describe, you can find lots of good there if you look for it. You can also find lots of trouble if that's what you look for as well. And that said, Gumersino, I wanted to ask you, how old were you when you lived in Spanish Harlem? Were you born and raised there and you lived there until you became a grown man? Or how long were you there Spanish Harlem?
Well, we came from Puerto Rico when I was a year old.
Okay.
So that was in 1953. And we migrated. Puerto Rico has like a tunnel to Harlem. Every Puerto Rican that comes from Puerto Rico lands up either in Harlem or South Bronx. So we landed up in Harlem, and I lived there for about until I was about 9 or so. Then we moved to the South Bronx, but life started real quick for me there in Harlem. I became a shoe shine boy. I was a hustler. I was a hustler from a young age. My father was a hardworking man, and I followed his footsteps. I used to shine shoes in the corner of 103rd Street, and I got to see a lot. I got to see.
How
a
old were you when you started shoe shining?
I was 7 years old.
Wow. Oh, my goodness.
I was 7 years old. I used to come out of school and take my shoeshine box. I had a little bodega. I used to keep the shoeshine box for me there. I used to go in there. That way I didn't have to go home and get it, waste no time. Make sure I got home before my parents did. So I sat in the corner and I signed shoes. And I signed some famous shoes, too. I signed Bobby V's shoes.
Yeah, I want to talk about that in this interview. Oh, my goodness, you were 7 years old. How did growing up, because I've talked to people in like the Watts or other areas, and I myself grew up in housing projects, and I've heard people say that where they grow up really almost determines their destiny. I personally don't agree with that, but I've had people argue vehemently with me about that. That almost if you grow up in an area where the economics may be depressed or whatever, that you just don't have a chance, and there's really not much you can do, and they'll just say, well, it's where I grew up. No matter what they do, it's where I grew up. I wanted to ask you. Yeah, but there are people who really do believe that, I guess, from what they see in their environment. How much did growing up in East Harlem impact you and the decisions that you went on to make as a grown man? How much would you say it impacted you, Gumersino?
Well, I can say to a certain age, it probably made most of my decisions. You know, maybe a good half of it, maybe 75%. But they weren't all bad decisions or good decisions. There were a knowledge that I obtained, you know, living in these places. But, you know, to say that because I live in poverty, to say because I am poor that, you know, I'm not going to make it, you know, that was not in my vocabulary at all. You know, I wanted to get out of it. I mean, it is much more difficult for somebody who's living in neighborhoods like this to get out. But at the same time, you should be able to get more courage to get out of there. And, you know, and this is why I feel that the same streets that almost consumed me were the same streets that taught me how to get out of there.
Wow. You mentioned Bobby V. Go ahead. You mentioned Bobby V. in your book, and also in the interview just a few moments ago. In your book, You Only Live Twice, and for our listeners, because I did a little research on him, because his name wasn't familiar to me just right from the start. Bobby V. is a famous singer, and he sung songs like A Fool Never Learns, Spanish Harlem, 16 Candles, which most people that might jump out at you. Twist and Shout is another one you might remember. And Forever Kind of Love. And I see that he's still performing after all these years. So
yeah,
I thought
he
that was good
is.
For him. Yes. When did you meet Bobby V? I know it was when you were a shoe shiner and you said you were 7, which tells me that you must have had a strong business acumen to be start shoe shining at 7 years old. But when did you meet Bobby V, and how did he kind of play such a pivotal role in your life?
Well, from Onion and Third Street, things would get a little slow. So I figure I'd move down where Lower Manhattan, where the white folks were. And I figured they had more money, and they were going to spend more money on shoes. And I guess I was wrong. And I stood by 186th Street, 184th Street, around that area. And Bobby was about, I think, was 17 years old then, or 18. He was just starting up in his career.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was shining his shoes, you know, I mean, guy was well-dressed and everything. And I said, he looks familiar. And he said, yeah. And we started talking, and he told me who he was. So I had a someone who confirmed that it was Bobby V. So he had promised me an album that day, man, and I was so happy. I told my friends for years, man, Bobby V is going to give me an album. And they used to ask me, did you get it from him? I said, no. They all laughed at me, you know. But when I wrote the book, I wanted to put closure on a lot of things in my life, and that was one of them. For some reason, that kept popping up at me, and I said, you know what, let me contact Bobby V, and I sent him an email. I sent him an email, and I told him the story, and he was, he was so thrilled with it. He emailed me back in 10 minutes. I got an email from him.
And he remembered you?
Yeah.
Wow.
And not only that, I got my album the following day.
Oh my goodness!
Autographed with his pictures and all kinds of stuff. So it was a great moment. I like to mention also that his wife is Karen is very ill, and I've been keeping her in prayers, and I've been asking everyone to pray for her.
Okay. Well, for our listeners and myself to, and I did read that on your website too. Lift up prayers, or either on his website to lift up prayers for her. I know you also know the boxing. The champion boxers, Michael Spinks and Joe Frazier, and you know also other boxers.
Joe Frazier, that's my man.
That boxing, I got to tell you, it has always had like a shady, I don't know, just like a little bit of underworld people involved in it. I don't know. It's always had that image to me.
Well, you're talking about the boxers or boxing itself?
The boxing, just the boxing world, the people
boxing
involved.
Boxing is the most corrupt sport in the world.
Yes, in a sport of boxing. But can you just tell us about our experiences that you had with some of the boxers that you know that are mentioned in the book, You Only Live Twice? And I want to talk about some of the challenges that you address in your book as well.
One of the most famous boxers that I met at my early age was Alex Ramos. Alex Ramos went on and became world weight champion of the world. And we met at the Apollo Boxing Club, which was the Jerome Boxing Club on 125th Street, right under the train station there. And I was not a professional fighter, so I was going from gym to gym and just keeping my skills up. And Ramos is already professional. And this time we first met, he was going for Golden Gloves. So I used to look at this guy and say, wow, this guy can really fight. This guy is so disciplined, you know. And I used to look up to him. I used to see him train. I used to try to train like him. I never could train like Alex. So one day I asked his trainer, his name is Nelson Camacho, to let me in the ring with Alex. And the guy looked at me and said, are you crazy? I may be, but that many people can beat me. I want to see it feels. Yeah, I don't know. So after talking, convincing, he said, oh, you want to get in the ring with Alex? I said, yeah. He said, all right, get in the ring with Alex. So I put on the gloves. Alex looked at me and said, are you kidding? Anyway, put on the gloves, and Alex told me a lesson that, you know, that I'll never forget. And he told me how to keep my left hand up. And every time you mention the name Alex Ramos, my eye twitches. You know, I get into this. Well, Alex is one wonderful man, a great human being. I knew our lives were going to be crossed again. I just knew it somehow, and we did. 30 years later, we did. He is the president of the Retired Boxers Foundation,
oh my goodness,
nonprofit organization that helps fighters all around the world. And this is a non-profit. These guys don't even get a penny for what they do. And he was, Alex and Jackie Richardson, the executive director, were the ones responsible for Rocky's Lockridge, getting him off the streets of Camden and put him into a program, a $100,000 program that Intervention paid for. So I was the middleman who went out there to see Rocky in Camden. It was a postman, Orlando, who contacted the Retired Boxers Foundation, and then they contacted me. I went out there, saw his condition, talked to him, you know, gave him a few bucks for food, stuff like that, and reported to the Retired Boxers Foundation, and then an Intervention. You know, they dragged their feet a little bit, but finally they were able to get him into a program. And this is the things that the Retired Boxers Foundation does, and what Alex Ramos does.
Well, thank God for them. I've heard so many stories about how not just boxers, but other athletes and entertainers can have so much money and be at the top. And you wonder, years later, when you hear that they are broke, you wonder, how did that happen?
A little different with boxing. Because boxing, most boxers don't get paid those big bucks, and people are really believe they do. The average fighter gets $500 to $700 a fight.
Wow.
You know, that's the average fighter. I mean, only 2% of these fighters, like De La Hoya, Mosley, stuff like that, are the ones that are actually going to make any money out of it. The 87% retire with brain damage, Denise. Some kind of brain damage and broke. There is no health benefits. There is no insurance. There is nothing for the fighter whatsoever. You die in the ring, your family will have to gather some money, bury you. You know, you get sick, you have to go on welfare. That's how it is. There is no bonuses. There is no compensation. There is nothing. And it's disturbing, you know, when you know that Don King made $1 billion out of boxing and all these other guys, you know.
Mm.
And they don't give back to boxing, you know.
Yeah.
But just recently he gave to the American Cancer Society $1 million check or something. And I said, I don't believe this. You made all this money from boxing.
Oh, yeah.
An organization bigger than the Catholic Church. You know, so I don't understand. So, you know, this is the sickening part of it.
Now, you earned your living in boxing. You weren't a professional boxer, though. So you just did boxing, you said, to stay in shape, and that's how you stayed around.
I was a good fighter. I was a natural. And, you know, as I got bigger, kids got bigger. But I stood smaller.
Now,
pretty short.
Do you think that when you went into that, in that environment, is that when your life started to spiral downward? Was there a period
Definitely.
In your life? Was there a period in your life when you hit a real, a pinnacle of success, like a high, and you thought you were going to stay there forever, and then things started to spiral downward? How did that downward?
Yeah. Well, we all have spirals in our life. The thing about it, I didn't have any training in life, so I took the wrong road again. And, boxing helped me a lot. The PAL, which the city here in Philadelphia, and I think nationwide, they're going to begin to close down, saved a lot of lives.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of poor kids, a lot of kids of color especially, look for the PAL as an escape. Not just for boxing, but you have pool halls, you have, you know, things that they can get into. Because the other places that have pool halls, they also have drugs and beer, but PAL don't. So when you get into these places, at least you're spending your energy there. So that's what I did with boxing. You know, I used to do drugs behind the PAL in the beginning, and then it was a police officer who told me, "Hey, come on inside." And I started to. We started playing pool, but I smelled the leather of boxing, you know, and the sweat. I said, "I think that's what I like." And that's when I started. Getting to the boxing, the PALs, but yeah, they have a lot to do with my survival, no doubt. You know?
Now, at what point? And I always wonder this about people in all different areas, not just drug or alcohol addictions, but other things that we do. That we could be gambling, could be just going in and out of just horrible relationships, domestic violence, on and on. You could go, and we just keep repeating the same mistake. At what point in your life did you say enough to yourself, and that you started to turn around and start heading along the right path? Was there something that happened that made you just say, you know what, this is it?
Well, there were many miracles, a lot of close calls. a lot of calls caused that. That I probably would have said, well, man, you know, you start reflecting back in your life and you start saying, well, I should have been dead, you know. I saw friends of mine dying of an overdose of heroin. I saw senseless shootings. I saw a police officer shoot a man while he was on the ground, handcuffed. I was beaten by police, four police officers, half to death. And the only thing that saved me was I was stronger than they were. But they tried to kill me from the 41st Precinct, Fort Apache. And that's how it was out there, you know. And I said, you know, how long do I want this? How long do I want these racist cops coming at me? How long do I want this drugs in my veins, the system, you know? I'm looking at my mother crying. It was just a list of everything that finally, you know, you reflect and say, man, this is wrong. And although I tried to immediately, you know, withdraw from that kind of life, it wasn't that easy because I was surrounded by it everywhere I went. I mean, it was designed for me to be in that environment. That, you know, there was no other way. Where did I go? You know, when you went to a Central Park or anywhere, you got chased by the white boys. So you always stood where you belong, kind of.
Yeah.
So that's how I felt that. I started to realize the ghettos are something made to confine one, you know, to keep you there.
Yes. Yeah.
That,
and then, like you said, you got to get out. Like you said, you got to see this. Yeah, this is, I don't even think they should exist, but you see that, and a lot of people, unfortunately, don't get out, because it's everywhere you go. It just could be blocks and blocks. And if you grow up like that in a kid, that's what you know as normal. And unless you see something else, you think that's all there is. So
it is
really, I think your message should be heard by just over and over and over again. You are very candid. People need to hear your message.
I don't pull any punches on it. I tell it like it is, and I think that's what we have to do today. You know, unfortunately, we just tell kids, you know, hey, say no to drugs, man, okay? Have a nice day.
Yeah.
Kids laugh at that. The kids today have tags. Here in Philadelphia, in Pennsylvania, they have it. I don't know anywhere else. They just have their program tags. Some of these drug dealers wear these tags, so other drug dealers go identify them.
Yeah.
So this is a joke, this stuff to them. So just say no to telling kids to say no to drugs don't mean nothing. You got to come out to them truthfully, honestly, bluntly, and say, hey, this is what's going to happen to you.
Yep.
You don't believe it? Look at my record. Look at this. Look at that. And
once
they get to the ending of the book, they'll see that, you know, it's not all worth it.
Yeah, I got to thank you for writing this book, and I got to go out and buy a copy. Just listening to you talk, you just your candor coming across. I know an actor and former WBC champion had this to say about You Only Live Twice. He said, I couldn't put it down. The message is clear, just as it's coming across in your voice on Off the Shelf today. Your wisdom needs to be heard in a world right now that needs to stop for a moment and listen. And this was from Victor, so I hope I say his last name right, Salecho.
That was Gary Stretch.
Okay.
How we stretch the movie star, yeah.
And then Victor says, I am from Russia, where growing up can be very difficult for a young man. The moment I began to read your book, I knew immediately that this book will also bring some peace to me. And Liz Gonzalez said, this book inspired me. I also enjoyed going down memory lane of the street games we played growing up, especially the fire hydrant, La Pampa. I wanted to ask you, how does it feel to hear the impact that you only live twice is having on reader? How does it feel when you hear how your book's impacting people who read it?
I love it. I said, you know, thank you, God, mission accomplished. That's how I felt. You know what I'm saying? Like, I knew this was an inspiration from God. And I tried writing this book about 12 years ago, Denise. And I couldn't get a word out. I couldn't get a word out of my head. And one day I was sitting down in my business with my daughter, and it just came out. I said, you know what? I'm going to write the book. She looked at me and said, okay, and she laughed. I said, no, I'm serious this time. That same night I got on it, and I didn't stop. So I finished writing the book. So I was definitely inspired by it, you know, and I knew what God wanted out of this. And to get emails from people who tell me that it did so good for them. I had this one lady who I don't think I should mention her name, but I've been talking to her for some time on Facebook. Mm-hmm. And and that. And she was going through a divorce, and she had promised me she was going to get the book some time back, and then she went and got the book.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, she got three copies of them. She gave one to her daughter and one to somebody else. And then she emailed me back and said she can't put the book down. The book is her refuge. Every time she gets discouraged, she goes inside the
wow.
book and encourages her. And that put tears in my eyes. You know, when
yeah.
I had her mother tell me
oh
that she had
goodness.
A 17-year-old and that he was using drugs since he was 17, he's 21 now. After he read my book, he wants to meet me. You know, that's
yeah.
I don't know how I can describe it. It's like, you know, thank you, God. That's all I can say. Thank
yeah,
you, God.
George
Foreman's daughter as well, you know, she said she loved the book. She said I should put it in it should be a screenplay. And that she went on and gave it to her daughter as well to read it. So
wow. I wanted to ask you, when you
Peter Foreman means a lot.
When you first thought about writing this book, did you just want to write your life story, or did you want to try to help people avoid making some of the mistakes that you – why did you sit down initially? Why did you say, I'm going to write this book? Why did you initially write?
My life story don't mean nothing if I don't share it. It ain't yours, so you give it away.
Wow.
So it definitely was for me, so others don't have to endure what I endure. I can't see a kid today being beaten by cops. I can't
yeah.
see a kid shooting drugs up his vein. I just can't see it. It's enough of this. So when I said enough for me, I meant enough for everybody.
Okay.
You know, we have a whole generation of kids
mm-hmm.
dying out there, lost. All our leaders dead, assassinated. What do they have to look up to?
Yeah.
Other than the hip-hop generation, which is a culture now, and it's a dangerous culture. You know, a lot of people think that hip-hop is just music, but it's not. See, I lived the hip-hop generation when it first started. Sugar Hill Band, DJ Hollywood. This is all started then, and there was a movement. There was a revolutionary movement out there with the Black Panther Party and the Young Lords Party. And these were revolutionary groups who said, off the pig, power to the people. This is what it was out there at that time, and this is what I was involved with.
Mm-hmm.
That movement was destroyed by the system.
Yes.
And then you had kids who had nothing... Where else to go? Martin X killed. Martin Luther King
mm-hmm.
killed. Where were the leaders? Where do they go? They turned to crime. They turned to drugs. They turned to gangs. They had to release some energy, and this built up a culture, which is the hip-hop culture, that involves everything. It involves drugs. It involves music. It involves the good and the bad.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, this hip-hop culture is still being controlled by big business. So, you know, it's a big, complicated thing, but it's definitely a culture that's out there that you cannot reach them just by telling them, hey, say no to drugs.
Yeah. what can each of us do, each person, even somebody who doesn't have maybe a lot of experience with intervention or prevention, but what can each person listening here to this show today do to help guide young people and adults, because there are adults who are still bound up into addictions who just
mm-hmm.
keep driving their lives off track, maybe not with addictions, but it could be something else. But I'm especially thinking about kids 5 to 12 years old. I don't know about you, but I know when I was 10, I thought I knew everything. I thought there was nothing for no one to tell me when I was 10 years old. So sometimes it's tough to reach some young folks who might think,
mm-hmm.
hey, look, I already know everything. You can't tell
mm-hmm.
me nothing. What can we do to help guide and get their lives back on a good track?
Well, first of all, we all knew everything until we reach a certain age. You know what I mean? We were young. We thought we didn't need to hear anything. I mean, I remember I was 12 years old. And I said, Mom, you don't have to tell me. I know what I'm doing. What the hell did I know at 12 years old? You know? You got to be blunt. You gotta go straight to the point. You know what I mean? You gotta give them examples. You gotta tell them, hey, remember that guy that was killed down here? He used that drug and his brain blew up. I mean, tell them the truth. You know what happened? The guy who got killed over here. You know, I mean, show him real life events. Show him reality. Not that, because things become like a fantasy after a while. If you keep telling these kids that, oh, that's no good for you, that's no good for you. The kid's been using it for years, so he said, hey, it hasn't done nothing to me.
Mm.
But you've got to show him some real-life stuff. So I would probably suggest first the book, because the book tells you right there what I went through. Right now, today, I have a couple of years to live, Denise. A couple of years to live. The reason? From the drugs that I did long, long time ago. It came back at me. I could have gone and decided to party my life away for the next 2 years or so that I have. No, but I decided to write the book. You know, I don't want this to be a waste. Mm-hmm. I really don't. You know, it's a reality. They read this book and they see, wow, this man is dying. Okay? And look what caused it. From 7 years old, a seven-year alcoholic, I was making sip guns at that time, shooting at people. I was a victim of one of the most racist attacks in New York. And then after that, I tried to bring police and community together. And this is what I'm trying to do now today. So I can live, you know, with this. You can live without it. You know? So I would probably suggest the book first. Mm-hmm. You know, and you know, it's a sad ending. It tells you, you know, I admit right now.
Don't tell. We don't want our readers. We want them to.
Well, people already know about it. That you know that I do have an illness. It doesn't. They can read the book and find out how this and how that. And you know, so there's a lot to read about it. But the stages that my life went through that I could have avoided, the stages that God allowed me to enter, so I can see. You know, I see people dying in front of me for me to live. For me, so I can continue to live, so I can write this book. So this is what happened.
And we thank you for that, because so many people do have these experiences, and like you said, a life that isn't shared. I mean, if you just live your life and you don't share it, what really does it mean? We're supposed to impact each other.
And yes, you give it away to this.
And I wanted to also ask you, Gummer Sindal, and I'm going back just in my mind, my life experiences and things that I've seen. Who do you think is more at risk of getting off track from living a rewarding, a good, enriching life? Do you say it's more like that you have to pay more attention to your young girls, or would you say it's more at risk for a young boy to perhaps get off track? Or does it make no difference whether it's a boy or a
girl? I don't think it makes much difference in today's society.
Okay.
You know, boys would tend to be more curious, you know, but girls could be victimized much easier. So, you know, in either way, you know, your boy can be victimized by some girls. You understand? And your girl can be victimized by the guy's neighbor's boy. So either way, no matter what it is, we, you know, they're all targets to it. So we got to protect them equally. You know, a boy can probably defend himself better, but look at the streets today. It's taking our young men.
Yeah.
The prison is taking our young men away from us.
Yeah.
You know, if it's not drugs, it's HIV or it's prison. You know, so and the girls today are being taught, you know, this easy type attitude thing that, yeah, I mean, which I've seen, it disgusts me sometimes. You go, hey, come over, I don't know from Eve and ask for the telephone number. She gives it to him, she goes to the car with him. Next thing you know, this girl's pregnant or missing. You know, the girls got to wake up too. These guys, there's the most players out there, guys, and they are girls. Mm-hmm. Today, you know, and the prisons are being filled today with women. I mean, it's just growing and growing. Women criminals.
I agree, and I think I don't know. Again, you were young. You said you experienced the same thing I did. I thought I was the only person who did this until I became an adult and I heard other adults say it. I don't know why when we're young we have to learn things the hard way. I'm not saying all young people do, but you just get it in your mind that you know everything. Your parents are dumb. Your grandparents are even dumber. and you learn things, and then later in your life you do things that even if you turn it around. I think about my great aunt who. For years she drank and drank, and a doctor told her, yeah, one more drink and that's it. And even though she stopped drinking, it came back with a penalty for her. But I know you're sharing real life experiences. You just try to continue to reach young people so they don't keep making the same mistakes. I wanted to ask you, are you working with any youth organizations or rehabilitation centers? If you could tell us about some of them that you send your book to, that you go to and speak at, that you maybe do workshops with or meet with the young people face to face at.
Well, I've always gone to the school prior to writing the book. I've always gone to the schools in here in Philadelphia. I'm not normally invited. I've adopted a school right across the street from my business, Woodrow Wilson Middle School, and I go there and I speak to the kids. I get the kids who graduate the top of the school. I give them bicycles. I give them gifts. I reward good. I reward them by working hard. So I've talked to them prior to that, and I do participate in some community organizations, whatever involves with kids, PDAC organizations, with the police organizations, and community organizations. But Elmer Thrower, a former NYPD police officer. Okay, what a coincidence, right? I meet the guy from New York who becomes a cop, becomes a friend of mine,
mm-hmm.
and from the same New York that tried to kill me. So I met him, and he's a screenwriter now, producer and writer and actor. And we met on Facebook, and then he came out. He came out here to visit me. We took some film and whatnot. We both were excited about this, and we decided that from this book, something should be born out of it. And it was the Youth Survivor Project. So the Youth Survivor Project now is a nonprofit organization that will be doing that. We'll be going to inner cities, speaking to the kids. We're going to have working on a sort of like a short documentary of my life from the shoeshine kid, from the drugs and whatnot, that we'll be showing. And we'll be talking about the book, but I'll be there as well talking to the kids. See, real life stuff.
Mm.
And I've also contacted Al Sharpton is listening. I've been trying to contact you for some time. We contacted also the 41st Precinct, the Fort Apache.
Mm.
I spoke to a commander there, and I'm going there in June, hopefully to... Well, not to make amends, but to forgive, not to forget, but to understand, and that we can work people and community together, you know. So
oh
I contacted
goodness.
Some of the old Savage Gold members
yeah.
of the gangs that I used to work with at that time, because when I became a member of the Young Lords Party, the revolutionary organization, we did a lot of work with the city gangs who were killing each other.
Yeah.
And we tried to divert them from killing each other to use that energy for the movement, and that's what we did. So we're gonna meet with some of them as well. And like I said, I've been trying to reach Al Sharpton also, and hoping that he can get involved with us. So I think it's gonna be a really good event there, and we're trying to get a final outlaw the group, great group. You ever heard of them?
No, I haven't.
It's a rap. You have to look them up. Everybody should listen to this guy. Just go to YouTube.
Okay.
And type in Final Outlaw. And the day I heard that song, I said, well, this guy read my book. I thought that Emma Thrall had given him the transcripts, I swear. I said, this guy is talking my book here.
Wow.
He's talking about the same things that I'm saying in the book. I said, I don't believe this. So I said, Emma, did you give him my transcript? He says, no, this song. And I found the song was out 10 years ago.
Wow.
And we contacted Final Outlaw, and hopefully soon we'll be working with them.
Mm.
You know, and I would love to work with that group, because what they say is what I have in my book, and I just love this guy. He's a young guy, but so much wisdom, and that he puts out in his music, and that is another form of reaching our children. If you know a lot of Christian groups are doing raps and doing stuff, because that's the way to reach the children. If you go through hip hop, you're gonna reach them. You're gonna do Frank Sinatra. Forget it. You ain't gonna reach them.
Yeah, yeah.
So music does do it. You understand? You have to get into them.
What do they enjoy? What attracts them? And then give them a positive message through that. What you are doing with your life is just, I mean, absolutely just phenomenal for off the shelf listeners who might have just joined us. Or for those who have been here since the start, we're speaking with Gummer Singdal Vadalt. He's the author of The True Life. It's a nonfiction book, You Only Live Twice. You can check it out at www.yoltbooks.com. Again, that's www.yoltbooks.com. At the end of the month, you can get the book at Barnes & Noble, Borders, and Amazon.com. But right now, you can get it today, and I encourage you to go get a copy at books.com. Gumbercino, he's very candid. You hear how he's coming across right here on the show, on Off the Shelf, and that's the same way that he comes across in the book. It's almost like he's talking directly to you and what he's done with his life, some of the mistakes that he made starting out as a shoe shiner at 7 years old, and what he's now doing with his life. It's just amazing working with police departments, an organization in New York that actually almost beat him to death. And then in Philadelphia, the youth, the schools that he's working with, he's taking the things he's learned and trying to help young people not make the same mistakes that he has made. I want to ask you next, and before we, I want to start to get a little bit into the writing process itself, and a little bit about the publishing process of it. As we come to the last few minutes of the interview, which has gone very, very quickly, I wanted to ask you, who did you admire when you were growing up? Who did you admire and look up to? I think sometimes the people that we admire and look up to are the people that we try to become like, that we try to emulate. So who are some of the people that you admired and looked up to when you were young?
There were several, and the reason there were several was because I had a little bit of them, or they had a little bit of me in them, either way. Muhammad Ali, not because he was a great, just the greatest fighter of all times, but his courage, his strength, stance he took against the American government and said, no, I'm not going to kill people who didn't call me a nigger. You know, things like that. I mean, he had that passion and the humor. I love all that about him. Malcolm X and Martin Luther King at the same time, because Malcolm X told us that we must live together, no matter what color you are, we must live together. And Malcolm X was the military part of that.
Yes.
You know, they were more militant, so I had a little bit of both in me. You know, I want to live together in peace with the whole world, but damn it, if you're going to give it to me, I'm going to take it. So I had a little Malcolm X, a little of Muhammad Ali, and a little of Martin Luther King in me. So the three people that I admire the most, you know. But there were other people that were close contact with me in my life, you know, where I was stationed at Children's Village, who actually said many things, you know, words that to today I repeat them to kids, you know, that have changed my life. So,
yeah, you, listening to you, like I was saying, I think the people we admire are the people we go on to either try to emulate or do. And it sounds like from what you're doing in your life now, you're doing things that those three men also did. You may not see it, but it's often the people we admire, somehow we end up sort of walking in their footsteps. And they did things to try to help youth, to try to help bring community and bring peace between whether it's the governmental organizations run, like the police and the community. You are actually doing those things now yourself. So the people you admire, you're actually emulating them in a way, and in a very, very good thing, and I thank you for that. I wanted to next ask you, Gumbercino, if you were talking face-to-face with somebody who was where you once were right now, what would you say to that person?
I'd probably smack them first. Stupid. What was wrong with you? You know, I would probably, you know, be strong. I said, mean, what are you doing? Are you stupid? I got scars in my body, Denise. Self-inflicted scars. Done with a razor blade. Because I hated what I saw. Because I couldn't beat the system, so I beat myself. So these scars remain with me to death. When I look at them, most of them are covered with tattoos now, but when I look at them, it reminds me of a place where I can never go back to. You understand?
Yes.
So when I saw them, the scars, when I saw them, I don't have any tracks of any more heroin tracks, but I do have the illness that gave me. And I tell them, I said, listen, this is what it's done to me. Are you serious?
Yeah.
Where are you going to take this? And I'll laugh at him. Things that I would see stupid, I would actually look at him and laugh. Now, you are stupid.
Yeah.
You are out there calling your sisters hoes. You're calling them bitches. And then you're shooting at your brother. And you say, power to the people.
Yeah.
Idiot. I mean, this is how I will come to some, how I've come to many of these guys. And many of these guys have appreciated that honesty. Some of them you cannot come up that strong because some of them are very sensitive and only use this front as an excuse to pretend that they're bad. So you don't want to hurt these people and lock them up neither. So, you know, there is a little psychology involved too. So you really have to feel some of these guys out because some of these guys, and I've noticed, are not real. You know, a lot of these people join gangs today and groups. I mean, they got all types of gangs, you know, but I mean, all through the city, there's hundreds of gangs. But this is because they want to belong to something, or they want to look cool, they want to wear a handkerchief, you understand? They don't realize that they are just being enticed into something that's gonna lead them into something very, very ugly, in the future. So these guys, you gotta approach them differently. You gotta grab them right from the collar and just pull them right back. And get your ass over here. You crazy? Do something, you know, and drive them around and show them, look, that's a real gangster, you know. Now I'm trying to get into the prisons now. I've wrote to the prisons where I want to speak to the men there as well. You know, it's not just the kids. I definitely want to reach the kids before they even get into the justice system.
Oh yeah.
You know. But I want to reach those out there who was misguided like I was, because I was lost and I didn't know where to go. So what happened? I went back down and there's things I know. All I knew was the ghetto. So what did I find? The ghetto.
Yeah.
So I kept going up and falling back in my face. Mm. So what happens to these guys in prison when they say, okay, your time is up. Have a nice day. He's lost. He is lost. Guess what's going to happen? He's going to be a repeat offender.
Yeah.
90% cannot... are repeat offenders.
Yeah.
Why? They have no direction after they come out of there. So these guys, I want to reach out and say, listen, there is hope.
Wow.
There is faith.
I cannot. I got to share this interview with our listeners and with other people. What you are doing, because you have lived it. So it's not like you just somebody looking in on that life and then giving your account of what you saw. You actually have lived it. So I think that has more. It's more empowering or effective when somebody's listening to somebody who's lived through something rather than somebody who's just observed something and then given an account of it. You're not just an observer. You're somebody who actually lived through it. So you definitely know what you were talking about. I wanted to ask you next, what was the process of writing You Only Live Twice like? I would just imagine if it was me writing this story, and I know you said you had started to try to write it 12 years ago and you didn't, but what are times that you thought, you know, I can't finish this because we live in some of this, it's just too painful. Was it easier for you this time? You said you just sat down and just literally just kind of just wrote the book, but I would imagine for me, I would be an emotional wreck.
I sat down and wrote, but it wasn't just round. Things in between that. You know, it was very emotional, Denise. Very emotional. From the beginning, from the very, very beginning, when I wrote that my parents came here from Puerto Rico and they had shattered dreams, right away, it took me right back to 103rd Street, you know, 110th Street in Harlem, where my mother and father used to both go out to slave in these factories and come back and bring nothing. And then just to pay the man. And, you know, and how hard they worked and how humble they were. My father, who never said a curse word, never drank or smoked. And he did nothing. All he did was work, never complain. And this society gave him nothing back. You understand? So that from the beginning was hard. So once I started writing that, I thought, you know, I'm not going to finish this. But he came to me again and says, you must. Somebody up there told me, you must. You got to. So I continue. And things were coming back, things I had to look into. I had to call to my family members so I could recall things clearly. And as I'm writing it, I lived it. I was living it. So this is why the book is so felt, and everyone tells the same thing, man, they can feel it. It's because I felt it when I wrote it, you know. It wasn't just like, oh, I remember this, let me write this down. You know, I felt each second of it. Even when I cursed back, I put it down. You know, that's the way I felt at that particular time. So it was very painful, the fact my dad passed away at 101 years old.
101?
He was 101 years old. He died at the year 207. And that was very, very, I don't want to talk about how, you know.
No, I understand.
There, but it was very, very difficult for me then. Very, extremely difficult.
I can't thank you. I can't thank you enough for what, oh my goodness, I cannot thank you enough. And for our listeners here at Off the Shelf, I do encourage you to get Gummer Singh, the Alva Doc. I'm so glad we were able to get him on Off the Shelf here today. His book, You Only Live Twice, Gummer Singh, the Alva Doc. If you're looking for his book by name, it's GUMERSINDOVIDOT. It's also up on Off the Shelf here at the station. You Only Live Twice. It's at Yolt Books, www.yoltbooks.com. And at the end of the month, it'll be available at Barnes & Noble, Amazon, and Borders. This interview has blown by so many other questions to ask, but we only got 4 minutes left. I wanted to ask you very quickly a couple of questions. Do you plan to write another book?
Yes.
Okay. And will it be... Is it going to be fiction, nonfiction?
No, I'm not going to write no nonfiction. No fictions. I mean, the Harry Potters, I let them write the Harry Potters. I want to write the real life stuff. The stuff that's going to help, the stuff that's going to, it's got to be truthful.
When do you think, for our listeners here, what can we expect to see that book? Do you have any idea of when it might be ready to be published and on the market for readers to pick up copies?
Well, I had to be honest with you. I just have some things written down of what I'm going to go, how I'm going to go about this, but I really don't have anything written down in a transcript. It's still in thought mostly than anything else. But I assure you, it will be. You know, this book literally twice. I wrote this book in about 5 months.
Okay. Okay, and I want to also...
I plan to stay at least a year in that other one. So that's what I'm, I mean, it's going to be a detailed event. I'm not even going to tell you what it's about.
Okay. I also want to let our listeners know, are you going to be at any upcoming appearances? If you can let us know about any interviews, book signings.
May 2nd at Artist Magnet Radio.
Okay.
I'll be blog radio. I'll be on there with Helmut Thrower. You can find that on my Facebook. And there'll be some all the events we posted on my website. We're going to be making a trip up to Dallas Ferry Children's Village to the kids out there. We're going to be traveling to New York with the 41st Precinct, Fort Apache, and bringing peace within the community and police. And there's some events coming up that will be updated on the website. So constantly go back to the website, yoltbooks.com, yoltbooks.com, and go to events, and you can see all the things we'll be doing.
Okay. And are you available to speak at schools, conferences,
yes,
whether it be writer con? And how would people contact you if they want you to come and speak at an event?
Well, they can go to the website. The information is there. I can give you a telephone number, 215-203-6301, and I'll scare them straight for you.
Okay, so you are available for our listeners who want to have Gummer Singh maybe come to speak at a youth event or even an adult event, a writer's conference. It could be any type, any event where, particularly I would say, reaching maybe youth or adults at risk. But you can go to his website, www.yoltbooks.com, and then reach out to him there. We only have a minute left, so I wanted to ask you very quickly if you're involved in any social networking like Facebook, Twitter. If so, if you could just let our listeners here at Off the Shelf know if they want to follow you online on Twitter or keep in touch with you on social networking. Is there a way that they can do that?
Facebook.com/ Initial G, last name Vido, V-I-D-O-T, G-Vido. So you can find me there. And from there, you can see my Twitter and everything else.
Okay. What last words, in just a few seconds, or what last words of encouragement or advice, Gummer Sindal Vidal, the author of You Only Live Twice, an absolutely amazing man, what last words of encouragement or advice would you like to leave with our listeners here at Off the Shelf?
It's not yours, you give it away, so give some away, help somebody.
Okay, I want to thank you so much. I'm so glad we were able to get you
here on
May the 1st today. I cannot thank you enough. I'm going to get your book as soon as I get up. I got to run the book. That's the first thing I'm going to do, because you the way you interview, oh, my goodness, you're just so candid and so forthright and just shooting straight from the hip that, you know, just to write a book like that means a lot. I want to encourage all our listeners to go get Gummer Sindal Vidal's book, You Only Live Twice. He is planning on writing another book, which I'm sure will be very exciting. And he's at yoltbooks.com. Thank you to all our listeners for being here with us today. I got to spread the word about this interview even beyond my normal marketing because of the depth of what Gummer Sindal shared with us today. Remember that you're truly loved, so valued, and so blessed. See you next Saturday at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. Thank you, Gummer Sindal. I'll shoot you an email.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye.